From Nairobi, Kenya, on a rather wintry July day, my name is Mushiri.
And I'm Gunida Mutuku.
And this is the Next African Agenda. Thank you for joining us. Today we're talking about open data and anti-corruption. This is two issues that have been joined at the hip from probably the very beginning of conversations on open government. Open data historically is very heavy on budget transparency, expenditures, etc., which was really, really in line with transparency, anti-corruption efforts at the time. But now we're in a pandemic, and we may have forgotten a little bit about what anti-corruption looks like for those of us who spent a lot of time on other adjacent issues of opening up government. But now we're beginning to see in some places what it looks like when there are no systems, when there are loopholes that can be manipulated and used to extract public funds for undocumented use. That's my new euphemism for corruption, extraction of funds and resources. So the last few months, actually starting last year, we've been looking at open data for anti-corruption as an opportunity for the open government partnership at the country level to bring new commitments to action plans. How can we leverage the OGP engagements and the national action plans to bring commitments that help address anti-corruption in ways that actually deliver on the ambitions that communities working on this have had for a long time?
Yeah, and maybe we can take this opportunity to probably throw in a few definitions for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with these terms that we are discussing. So open government partnership is actually a multilateral initiative that brings together various governments and civil society to create concrete commitments towards opening up government, ensuring transparency and accountability, and using new technologies to improve how service is delivered to citizens and the overall governance processes in these countries. So these commitments are typically co-created between the government and the civil society, communities within each of the country, and open data and anti-corruption have typically been some of the commitments that have been made over the past 10 years of the OGP existence.
Yeah, and there's a difference. I think it's good to point out between open government partnership mm-hmm. and open government.
Yes.
Right, because in some instances they get conflated. People hear open government and they think open government partnership. Mm-hmm. And they're not the same thing.
Exactly. So the Open Government Partnership really is a very specific initiative. And so these commitments are created typically every 2 years. And then there are mechanisms to try and keep the governments and the various civil society actors to account based on the commitments that they have made for around open government.
Exactly. Because I think we've seen over time how people react when they are unable to separate the two, despite the fact that they are very related, that the Open Government Partnership is a platform that advances reforms and progress on opening up of government. And open government is by itself just a philosophy, an ideology, an approach to governance that is, in many instances, enshrined in law. Mm-hmm. In statutes, both at the national and international level. Mm-hmm. So before I get carried away and start talking about the African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance, or the African Convention on Anti-Corruption, I thought maybe it'd be a good start, for us to jump into what you have been looking at, mm-hmm. What this piece of work mm-hmm. on open data and anti-corruption has been about for you mm-hmm. in the last in the last number of months.
Yeah, so through this particular project, the idea was to really review these commitments that have been made, especially those that try and use the transparency mechanism to fight corruption, transparency here being brought about through the release of data. But over time, I think it's been realized through various research on the OGP mechanism that open data commitments typically tend to focus on the release of the data to fight anti-corruption and not so much the theory of change or the, you know, underlying motivations and utility of these data sets towards fighting, you know, corruption. So therefore, without really thinking about the political dynamics and the technical requirements to open up data and use it to fight corruption, then the expected impacts are actually limited and might not be realized as quickly as possible just by opening up data. So this project aims to find, you know, like a consistent thread, those practical tactics that governments and civil society actors who want to use open data as a tactic to fight anti-corruption can follow and use in order to increase the impact, and especially over the long term, of anti-corruption efforts brought about by the use of open data. So the idea of this project really was not necessarily to dictate to countries how this is done, but collect these tactics and practical ways by engaging with partners locally to co-create what such tools would look like to support the creation of very strong open data for anti-corruption commitments for GP.
So going beyond just publishing data, going mm-hmm. beyond just publishing names, mm-hmm. you know, because I think with publishing of data, you're beginning to see the same thing that we saw with name and shame campaigns.
Exactly.
That data by itself, out of context, without speaking to the broader issues, you know, doesn't get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Name and shame only works when there's shame. And I think what we've seen is that we have some very, very shameless people, in our public sector. They're the minority. I mean, I believe they're the small apples that mess up the whole bunch, but they can be pretty shameless. You know, so name and shame by itself, you know, wouldn't work just the same way a data set by itself might not get a job done.
Exactly. And so then what... And even just the data set, how is it going to be accessed, by which parties, what technical capacity do they have to work on this? And then, as you're saying, what really is the end goal of naming
mm-hmm.
or of exposing these issues of corruption? So I think strong open data for anti-corruption commitments can provide evidence to prosecute, for instance, as one of the mechanisms to fight corruption. If you have evidence of misuse of funds through data, then that's a stronger case in the justice system. But the question is, how then do you tie, you know, that whole process from releasing data sets to actually a strong anti-corruption effort?
Yeah.
So why, Mushiri, do you think we are having this discussion right now in the middle of a pandemic? And why is it important?
I think it goes without saying, during a pandemic, during even an epidemic, an emergency, a public health emergency, what you're going to find is a health system that it doesn't have the inventory it needs to respond adequately everywhere. So the need for procurement, you know, comes up, but not just any procurement. This is procurement being conducted under extraordinary circumstances. So there's a need to procure quickly. There's a need to procure during a time when you're purchasing and availability of whatever you're trying to get is not as straightforward as you would under normal circumstances. You're looking for very specialized equipment, very specialized inputs, and that can create an opportunity and a loophole for leakage of funds.
Yeah, definitely. There's a need for accountability, you know, given the rapid need to, you know, deploy resources. And when we think about the situation of the pandemic we are in, right now we're in the response mode, but we'll need to recover from this eventually, from the eventual economic fallout and other, you know, collapses of your normal social infrastructure that will arise due to the fact that we've been sheltering in place and, you know, had to find socially distant methods to carry out day-to-day activities. So I think that radical shift in how things have to be done because of the urgency required in interventions can, as you mentioned, can definitely create leakages and opportunities for corruption. And so we can't just like forget the, you know, the norms and the public trust around usage of resources just because we're in a pandemic.
I have, we've seen the same kind of challenge that is being faced in Kenya with the allegations of corruption and specifically in procurement related to pandemic response happening even in developed countries. The US, you know, I remember seeing this case of some guy on Twitter who snagged himself a very lucrative government tender to supply ventilators to the city of New York. He has no history, no factory, no education, no background in ventilators. He just went on Twitter and said, yo, hit me up if you want ventilators. I got this.
Definitely.
And quite a few million dollars were heading his way. Just like that. So there's that one way to speak for a rapid response.
Exactly. But that's
the other problem there is, you know, you need all these other checks and balances, you know, to still be in place that would normally apply in a non-pandemic situation.
Exactly. I know we are probably tired of hearing this phrase, but definitely these are unprecedented times and the world is just grasping on tactics, you know, to basically to evolve to the current situation and try and still find normality even when we are not sure what to expect on a day-to-day basis.
You talked to quite a few people who are working on anti-corruption in Africa. What have you been hearing on their views around, you know, where the possible loopholes are, where the areas we need to be concerned lie? What's the word on the street?
Okay, I think based on the conversations we've had with experts working in this space, I tend to categorize issues of especially corruption emerging in maybe three ways or two ways. The first is in the procurement process. So as we've been talking about, like, given that this is a health crisis, there's the need to rapidly procure specialized equipment, such as the personal protective equipment, the ICUs, beds, the ventilators, and in a manner that might not follow the usual, you know, tendering process. So procurement definitely is a major issue that could likely face opportunities for corruption. The second one I would say is in the allocation of resources that have been redirected towards the responding to the pandemic. So now not necessarily just the procurement, but even the budgeting, the allocation of funds, be it from private sector donations or international donor donations to reallocation of government budgets. Does the law support how these allocations are done right now and the need for supplementaries to the budget? Those are questions and opportunities definitely that arise for corruption. And the third is in the distribution. So who's actually benefiting from what has been budgeted for, what has been procured, towards fighting the pandemic. And when we talk about distribution, now we're not just talking about the funds or access to healthcare. We're also talking about the social safety nets we've had and we've seen across the world, that governments have to start creating stimuli packages to support people who've lost their livelihoods and opportunities for income because of just having to shelter in place. So is there equitable distribution of this social infrastructure that has been mobilized to fight the pandemic? And so it'll be very interesting to dig deeper into these three issues and how our experts also foresee that opening up data could help reduce corruption that would arise during this pandemic response and recovery phase.
Here's Jessica Musila, Open Government Fellow at Local Development Research Institute.
So for me, I'm looking at it, contracts to do with education, because education is going to, they are going to have to do en masse provision of masks for schools. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all that is an opportunity. That's a big community opportunity for corruption. Mm-hmm. Place, another place that will be interesting, any food that is being given, whether it's being given, you know, especially if physical food is being given. Because mm-hmm. you see the one for money, when they're being given money, it's easier to track.
The cash transfers
are easier to track. Mm-hmm. But the one where they are actually buying the food to give, mm-hmm. Someone can put in their money, their stuff there and pay themselves and mm-hmm. and not have a big contract and stuff like that. So procurement is a big opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier about how you'd, you know, other than the potential corruption that might come through the procurement, say, of ICU beds. You might also have, you know, corruption when the ICU beds have been acquired, they've been procured, they're in place, but someone with the money is able to have their relative or themselves leapfrog people who were next in line to get it onto a bed. And then possibly also people who put down a deposit and have their bed, you know, waiting.
Exactly.
You know, at the expense, of course, of people who are very, very ill and not as politically connected or as financially liquid.
We've had instances that some of our politicians have actually installed private ICU beds in their residences. And the question is, what resources have been used to procure these? Because they might ideally be diverting these resources from public hospitals who need these to serve a wider population than just individual interests. That being said, I think before we discuss corruption, we have to understand like what financially it means, especially when we start talking about procurement. We have to understand that there are underlying factors that cannot be changed. For instance, given that we've had to start procuring health equipment and protective equipment in the middle of a pandemic, it's not that this equipment was just lying in a warehouse, you know, waiting to be distributed or to be purchased. So the factors of supply and demand are actually very skewed at this process. And so things such as having to procure, let's say, ambulances or ICU beds at a much higher price than would be a typical procurement process have to be considered. And that may not necessarily be a corruption issue. And that was something that one of our experts from TI Kenya actually brought to attention, that even as we reflect on where the likely leakages are, we have to be very aware of the fact that procurement generally will be more expensive right now. And so when we start thinking of data sets and how to keep government transparent, we have to bear in mind that reality of rapid response during a pandemic.
Here's Irungu Hilton, the Executive Director of Amnesty International Kenya.
I think we need to separate out what you're framing as basic principles of economics, which is, you know, supply and demand tension. And I think that is definitely a legitimate argument for people to make. But I think in this case, There are a number of things that have obviously demonstrated that the lapses in procurement policy and our Public Finance Act actually led to a reduction of value for money from the Kenyan taxpayers. So just to give you some examples, I spoke about essentially setting up a online portal specifically to have companies that are procuring services and goods for our government during this time to be identified and publicly available for people to look at on the internet. I spoke about contracts that are being signed with these companies being put in the public domain. And lastly, I called for an update or a progress status report to be given to Kenyans on the quality of services being prepared by these countries, by these companies. And the rationale for that was really that, government has a responsibility to demonstrate, even in a pandemic, but actually particularly in a pandemic, that it's spending its money wisely, or spending our money wisely. And for that reason, an open portal would have made a big difference. As we've seen with some of these 12 companies, the names of the company directors are not available. In some cases, these are shell companies, and they are essentially fronts for other companies that have taken place. We know that members of parliament, are not yet named, but are directors in some of the other companies that are named. And I think there is definitely, a need, even during a time of pandemic, to deal with issues of insider trading, conflict of interest. These are all basic principles, not to restrain the market, but essentially to ensure that different companies are not having unfair competitive advantage in moments like this.
Here's Harriet Washira, Program Coordinator, Transparency International Kenya.
But having said that, the points we need to look at, or the issues we definitely need to look at, are how that procurement is being done. One, because it's characterized as urgent need procurement in law. Mm-hmm. And it's not covered in the publish. It's not, the law excludes it from publication, like, on PPIP. It's very clear. It excludes publication of urgent need procurement. So when government is procuring, when they're doing all that we are not able to see. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe if we were to say, maybe publish once a quarter, because it's understandable that the priority is to procure first, then publish later. That is completely understandable. But at some point, you need to tell us how you went about that procurement. So that the procurement bit is still an issue, and especially in a skewed market, like I said.
In Kenya, we find ourselves in a slightly different situation compared to, say, a country like Ghana, in that we are a devolved system of government, where the functions of government have been shared out between the national and subnational levels. So there are certain functions that are not the national government's business. And healthcare is one of those sectors that are devolved, significantly devolved compared to what you'd find with agriculture that has some concurrency in some places. What are you seeing and hearing, from the people we've spoken to about this kind of governance framework in the context of a pandemic?
You're absolutely right. What's been interesting is that as soon as the pandemic became a reality, especially once Kenya confirmed its first case, the Ministry of Health actually stepped up and then started mobilizing all these different resources, different stakeholders, to really start responding to this pandemic. And so why this is really interesting is that a lot of donor funds, as well as loans and other support from various institutions, have actually been channeled towards the Ministry of Health. And then we're seeing a situation where the Ministry of Health is starting to procure, be it ambulances, ventilators, protective equipment, the testing kits and the reagents. And But at this, this seems to be quite different from what is expected, given that the Ministry of Health is actually a policy institution and not an implementing institution. So when you, as one of our partners actually pointed out, when you go to the back of it, the Ministry of Health doesn't actually own any hospitals or does not have any testing labs. These are all run at a devolved level or as a public sector entity. And so then where then are these ambulances being procured? These ambulances are being procured on behalf of who? Or these testing kits will be directed to who? And the same thing. So we are seeing a scenario where the Ministry of Health, which is a policy institution, procuring equipment, allocating funds, and yet they have now a mandate to start distributing to the implementing partners, be it the county governments or the referral hospitals or other private sector stakeholders who are supporting this pandemic response. So there, of course, would arise an opportunity for corruption, given that this is not a normal framework of operation for the ministry.
Just thinking about, you know, the kind of data that would really be useful. When you talk about opening up data for anti-corruption, this procurement data seems to me like one of those high opportunity, high profile, high impact kind of data sets that could be, you know, leveraged and used by partners and even working at either at the watchdog level or even just at research and curiosity. It's a data that has huge value. Are there any other data sets that have come to mind that are high value?
So one of the very interesting data sets that was brought to my attention by TI Kenya, they have been collating media reports as well as exchequer releases and other donor funding announcements in a public portal. So that is monitoring right now all the funds donated towards the pandemic response. And so it's very easy to start seeing how much money has been allocated towards this, responding to this pandemic from the various sources, be it from the Treasury, from international donors, or from private sector donations. And the next thing is actually to start seeing where have these funds been allocated. So this is not your typical open data set, you know, from a public institution or from a government ministry, but from media reports. But it's a very valuable data source to track funds that have been allocated for COVID-19.
And I imagine it's both funds and resources, like the Jack Ma Foundation donations and PPEs, etc. And in following those up, and the questions about how some of these things seem to have vanished into thin air at the airport. You know, it's the kind of data that you might not have found out of an administrative system in government, but you know, it's coming out from a third party source.
And something also that we are learning is that the current law actually has exceptions for emergency procurement, in the sense that they can single source at that point, or they can, you know, they don't have to put out your open, they don't have to put out this data on the open contracting portal immediately. However, what would still be valuable is even after the fact, these tenders or these procurement processes should be published, in as much as it may not be in a timely fashion. They still should be published on the portal, and people can then continue to follow then once funds and other resources were mobilized, how were they allocated and who are the beneficiaries, especially when it comes to companies that were contracted to do this distribution work.
Definitely interesting data. Is there any other data set that comes to mind?
As the pandemic becomes a sub-national issue as well, so beyond just the at the national level, having the main government responding, but also at the county level. One data set that was actually important to some of the people we talked to was data sets on the availability of, you know, testing facilities. Where at the county level should you go get a test, or which hospital has ICU beds? Where should you be referring patients to? COVID-19 has actually exacerbated the need for specialized healthcare, because we are seeing that the people who are at the highest risk have underlying, you know, issues. And so, if another data set that could be opened up is, where are specialist facilities available, or where can we find doctors who are specialized to treat a certain condition? So it might not be your usual anti-corruption data set, but it's very important to show where resources are being targeted, because at the end of the day, these specialized facilities need to be paid for. And so it's very important to know, for instance, even how much a test costs, you know, at a specific point over another, so that people are not taking advantage of guys who are in a crisis.
This information asymmetry to, you know, take advantage and get preferential access when other people can't.
Exactly. So, and of course, in as much as allocations are being done and in as much as resources are being mobilized, there still needs to be open budgets are still very critical towards fighting corruption, so that we do know that what has been planned for is what is being spent appropriately. So the budget itself and the supplementary budgets around the expanded health system requirements need to be opened up as well.
Any ideas, any views? I mean, I have mine. But are there any ideas, any views that are coming through on how GP as a mechanism can be leveraged to advance anti-corruption efforts, and especially, you know, open data for anti-corruption?
I think, granted, the fact that OGP is a multilateral initiative, and OGP has both the contributions of governments and civil society coming together to really, you know, push for these anti-corruption efforts. In as much as it's not directly linked to the OGP process, I think that there's a lot from the OGP mechanism and the existing relationships between civil society and government agencies that can be leveraged to ensure that civil society is situating itself in places around or in institutions that are being mandated with oversight of the use of resources that have been allocated towards the pandemic response. For instance, in Kenya, we have the National Emergency Response Fund. Through OGP, I see an opportunity for civil society to actually participate as an accountability partner, or as an, you know, a support partners in these agencies, to ensure that they remain accountable to the people of Kenya. They remain these institutions that are mobilizing and spending funds remain accountable to citizens on how their funds are being used, in as much as we are not in a ordinary procurement or budget cycle when it comes to the pandemic response.
Mm, absolutely. Think about the fact that OGP action plans are this vehicle that carries a commitment that has been co-created for a 2-year period. There's a big opportunity there, especially for new transient institutions like the COVID Emergency Response Funds that we're seeing across a number of countries. The COVID Innovation Task Force, you know, or whatever it's called here in Kenya. I keep mixing up that name. These are transient institutions with a specific mandate situated in government. They have an opportunity as transient institutions to participate in OGP by co-creating with civil society a commitment that goes into an action plan. I think that could be a really exciting opportunity for governments to bring an elevated level of accountability to how they're handling the pandemic response and recovery. The amounts of money you're seeing coming in from various stakeholders requires us, I think, as a continent, to signal trust to, you know, partners in the private sector and in indigenous philanthropy, so that the next epidemic, the next pandemic, we don't have to rely as heavily on international philanthropy, but our local philanthropy step in to close that gap.
So the surest way of ensuring that the procurement cycle has integrity is really end-to-end documentation, and allow that to be in the public domain so that people can essentially see where did the money that was put aside for face masks, for health workers, where did it actually end up? How much or how many face masks were delivered to Kenyatta National Hospital? How many went to Bagathi? How many went to the mandatory quarantine centers that were set up to protect our people and to isolate them during the time that they needed to take in order not to infect their loved ones and their people? And if you don't put that in the public domain, then it is completely impossible to be able to track that. And I think that's what the cartels essentially thrive off. They know that this information will not be delivered in the public domain. So when the Kenya Medical and Practitioners and Dentists Union demand explanations on where did the funding for face masks and HAS masks suit, where did that money go to? What they're essentially asking is that these supplies were delivered to the front line of our work. When police officers individually ask for face masks, and they individually ask why they are receiving one face mask per week rather than the required number of face masks that they need to run 12-hour duty shifts. This is the kind of information that's required to also be put in the public domain. So it's not just the contracts and the bill of lading and the delivery notes. It's also about, you know, on the ground, qua ground, are we seeing these supplies and goods reaching where they should be? And I think that's the auditing that needs to be put in the public domain as well.
One of the things about the response and recovery efforts is the distribution of these resources to individuals. Now, OGP has tried, has centered itself as being an inclusive and participatory process, ensuring that even through OGP, no one is left behind. So in the same vein, even as we start thinking about how people are, being supported to recover from this pandemic, OGP, again, is a really good mechanism to ensure that there's equitable, you know, allocation of resources to not just to the communities that are the, you know, the usual suspects, but to also marginalized
beneficiaries state philanthropy.
Exactly, but also to marginalized communities, to ensure that there's a gendered response, you know, and that women, youth, the disabled, and other marginalized communities actually benefiting from all these resources that have been mobilized for pandemic response and recovery.
One big opportunity for our OGP permanent mechanisms is bringing on board those autonomous or semi-autonomous, in some countries I imagine, institutions tasked with anti-corruption efforts. You know, your anti-corruption commissions or authorities, they tend to be quite powerful. Some have investigatory powers, and many of them, you know, have the ability to maintain pressure on the public sector for accountability. We saw the level of scrutiny the public protector in South Africa brought to the administration's use of public funds. And that was at a level, I think, that in many of our African countries we found enviable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we're seeing it now in Kenya with a revitalized anti-corruption commission and this troika of the DCI and the Director of Public Prosecutions, together with the East African, the Ethics and Anti-Corruption, that EA just feels like it should be East Africa. The Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission. Bringing these actors, these institutions to the OGP mechanism, I think would serve our open government efforts.
And the Justice Department, the judiciary is actually invested in prioritizing, execution of swift justice against corruption perpetrators. So definitely OGP can further strengthen the existing relationships, and given that the response period of the pandemic is not going to be 1 month, 6 months, we'll probably be doing this over a long period of time. A lot of these actions can be concretized in the next action plan. Speaking of the next national action plan, I know these have been delayed right now. The cycles are probably not following the usual timelines.
Yeah, they're out of sync.
Definitely. Yeah. But I see then an opportunity for the learnings that we are picking up by observing how open data is being used for anti-corruption efforts just at this moment can definitely be used to make stronger commitments in the next action plan, especially commitments that institutionalize these efforts over a longer period of time, and that take into account that there is the likelihood of having to, think about rapid responses and establishing mechanisms that take into account the need for a rapid shift in methodologies towards whether it's resource allocation or equitable distribution of funds to fight the pandemic. This can definitely be institutionalized.
So I think there are exciting opportunities coming up for a lot of us working on anti-corruption, working on open government, to see progress that has been powered by open government commitments in the action plans, in the OGP action plans. We look forward to working with partners in Africa, especially in the priority countries right now, which are very few, but in other countries as well where OGP action plans will be co-created, just to see the extent to which commitments that bring really usable open data for anti-corruption, can make their way into the public space. So we end this episode with some insights from Natalia Carfi. She works with Open Data Charter, with whom we are collaborating with on this open data for anti-corruption work in the context of the Open Government Partnership.
After implementing for a year the project on open data and anti-corruption commitments for the multi-donor trust fund from World Bank and OGP, both in Africa and Latin America, we have some insights that we've learned. So still political shifts in power, not even administration, just ministerial changes can still postpone the open government agenda. With COVID, most of the countries that were co-creating this year actually stopped or postponed their co-creation, but there has also been a lot of changes in the ministerial level that made the open government overall agenda shift.